It was, and it was.
Yeah, so I think you just put this under your arm, then.
Under what?
Yeah. And it was yeah. also it's about great. how's it doing?
It's fine. It's recording.
And also how I surreptitiously recorded Harvey Goldberg stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, I would have gotten beaten to death, you know, by his thuggish minions if they knew. I'm telling you, you know. But back then, I was fearless.
So, Sydney, it's great to welcome you back to Madison. This is John Tortorisi, and we're interviewing Sydney Iwanta, who attended UW in what year?
From 1967 to 71.
Okay. And you graduated in history and...
History and film.
History and film. Okay. So where were you born? Here in Madison?
Milwaukee.
Oh, Milwaukee. Okay.
And my parents came here in 1950, and I found them about 1951. They just left me. They left me in the Valete area on Valete Street in Milwaukee. Both my parents were from Europe. My mother was from England, Cockney, and my father was from Vilna, Lithuania. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was a professional soldier. So, he fought from 1939 to 1945.
In
Europe.
In the U.S. Army?
No. Oh, no, no, no. My father was, he came from a long line of Vilna rabbis. He said, no, I don't want to do that. So he became a soldier. And at that time, Lithuania was part of Poland. So he became part of the Polish cavalry. And I still have someplace either in my apartment or my sister's, my father on his stallion in all his regalia as a Polish cavalry, a captain, Polish cavalry officer. And everybody knew he was Jewish, but I guess, you know. And my father, you know, like all Europeans at that time, it was fluent in like a half a dozen languages, you know. He knew Russian, Polish, Lithuanian, during the war, he learned enough, you know, French and German. Well, he also knew Yiddish and Hebrew, and so I mean, you know, he's that's what he did. He was a soldier, and I think I actually told Professor Mossy this, that my father was part of the last cavalry charge in European history. At the siege of Warsaw, it was, you know, horse flesh against, you know, the Wehrmacht. So guess who won, you know, but what was left of the Polish army fled through Yugoslavia into Italy, because Italy had not declared war at the time. And my father ended up, you know, in the French army, where he conveniently was left behind, you know, when all the British left. So he was captured at Dunkirk.
Oh, wow.
And he spent 4 years in a German prisoner of war camp. And they knew he was Jewish, but it was not run by the SS. It was run by the Prussian officers. So, you know, they took out his appendix. That saved his life, you know. He escaped a few times. They shot him. They brought him back. He used to point out the bullets in various parts of his body. His favorite movie was The Great Escape. It was an amazing thing. And then when the Americans liberated the camp, they gave him, like, I guess, an M1 rifle and said, you know what? We need soldiers, you know, to defend us against the German. And he says, what? And he ended up as part of the Battle of the Bulge. He just, you know, this is like, yeah, you know, it's, He was like, you know, the Tom Hanks character, you know, so
Well, this may explain some of your interest in history. Sounds as if you...
Oh, I always... that along with the fact that, you know, where we settled in the Greenbush area in Madison had all these old people. I was like one of the few young kids. I mean, you know, but everybody, they were old, you know, the Italians, the Jews, old blacks from the South, and basically everybody sat around telling, all these old people sat around and told stories. And I was just amazed by this stuff. I mean, you know, I heard everything, and I always thought all the Italian guys, they used to tell me stories about the fact that they were made men. Or, you know, that they had worked for Capone. And, you know, the old Jewish women would tell me about the pogroms in Russia, you know, and Poland. And the elderly blacks would tell me about the Jim Crow South. Well, yeah, it was the Jim Crow South. And we're talking about old people. And I'm like 5 or 6 years old. And I'm surrounded by like 70 and 80-year-old people. So we're talking about people who were born in the 1880s, you know. And then there were those who'd like to tell me stories about how they had fought in the Revolutionary War, and I was 6 years old, okay, you know, and the Civil War, and you know, the these guys had met Sitting Bull and Cochise, and I'm just, wow, damn, you know, and the old ladies would feed me pastries, so I was a great audience. I was just a great audience for that. So
that culture of storytelling in that neighborhood,
it's lost, but it was just lives, wonderful.
It lives virtually in the sense that it's still in the minds of those few people that remember the neighborhood. It's still so powerful.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking of, did you ever know Boof Trenilia?
Yeah. Buffo,
He was the quintessential Greenbush storyteller.
Yeah.
That's what he did his whole life. I don't think he ever had another job.
I don't know.
He was a bailiff, I guess.
I went to high school with, with his relatives and with the Skirus and a number of the Italians. And what was wonderful about the Greenbush area was that because everybody, as diverse as it was, everybody had one thing in common, a painful past. So, you know, I never heard anti-Semitic slurs. Nobody had black slurs. Nobody, no, they just didn't, because there was always this anguish about so many of these people because they had escaped, and they all escaped from some horrific environment, you know, and it was working class. It was the only integrated area of Madison, and
in some ways it was the other in Madison, wasn't it?
Because you know what it was? It was an embarrassment to a lot of people because it was so close to the state capitol. West Washington Avenue in the 40s and 50s was really a den of taverns. I mean, it really was. What happened was that it just became too much of a, I wouldn't call it a ghetto because it really wasn't, but it was too much of an eyesore. And that sort of eyesore really began to weigh heavily on people in the city council. Obviously, the state assembly. I mean, you'd drive up there. This was before John Nolan. You'd drive up there, and you'd see, you know, like the Gerke junkyard. I think it was also the Paley junkyard that was there. You know, which were great places to play in if you wanted to be surrounded by things that could kill you repeatedly. You know,
nails.
The Snikers, yeah.
We used to play in the Snikers.
Yeah, and so again, you know, it was a historical environment. It wasn't like, oh, I'm living in Shorewood Hills, so you know, it's like I'm surrounded by rich people. Who cares? There was really that sort of Alan Lomax kind of storytelling, you know, and it was And they would, it was always in a lot of broken English. And it was just, these people were like making up words, you know. And I would just sit there, you know, mesmerized by this stuff, you know. And I just thought, wow, this is.
So was there a teacher, an individual that encouraged you to attend UW, to major in history?
Well, let me tell you something. Back then, I was one of those high school students that could barely spell high or school. And, you know, they also discovered that I was like dyslexic, you know. So by the time I was in eighth grade and I was ready to drop out already, I was reading on a third grade level. And it was a teacher who finally discovered this, a guy named Mark Parrish, in eighth grade, who, believe it or not, while I was looking for high school classmates, I went out looking for him because he saved my life. He, you know, when they talk about teachers saving a student's life, that was the prime example, at least for me. And because, you know, every day after class, you know, I had to spend an hour before I went home in his class where he basically tutored me. He, you know, and he brought up my reading level from like a second or third grade to, by the end of the year, like ninth grade level. And prior to that, I hated reading because I couldn't read. I just hated it. And as an aside, I could read Hebrew easier than I could read English, you know, like for my bar mitzvah, that kind of stuff. And then as soon as I had that, I quit that too. But I mean, you know, but that's a different story. But the fact is that teacher, and he was a former Teamster, and he was built like a beer barrel. I mean, he was like maybe 5'6", 5'7". He looked like a professional wrestler, though, you know. And so he would tell me stories about the Teamsters. And everything was storytelling around. I never wanted to just hear lessons. I wanted to hear stories. Even in Longfellow grade school, we had teachers who would read us. And some of those teachers were older than dirt. I mean, I remember going up to my sixth grade teacher and asking her if she had actually fought in the French and Indian War, because you know, because she was just old and wizened. She must have been born about 18. This was 1959, so she was born probably around 1890. You know, and it was like, you know, when they would just sit and reminisce. Everyone loved to sit and reminisce. Once you ask somebody, tell us about yourself, that sort of thing. You know, they told about, you know, growing up in Kansas, outhouses, you know, there were no cars, there were no airplanes. And, you know, it was like all that kind of stuff. And I, again, that sort of stuff mesmerized me. And but getting back to Mark Parrish, he was the teacher. And I looked him up, and he's now retired. In Florida, he had no idea who I was, but you know, because he had tens of thousands of students, that kind of stuff. But I basically told him this. I thanked him, and he says, "You know, you're about to make me cry." He's like 80 years old now, and I says, "Well, you saved my dimpled white ass, man. I mean, I was heading for some no good areas, you know, and there were a lot of students at Central at that time who didn't have that sort of care, and they dropped out, you know. And I was just very, very lucky.
So you came to campus in 1967?
All of us could. See, that was the other thing. I couldn't probably get into the UW now. But back then, if you were a townie, you were automatically accepted. Mm-hmm. So, sure. I mean, you know, even though I had maybe a high school, maybe a B level, you know, you were accepted. I mean, my first class at the UW was get rid of English first, you know, English comp. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, But after that, it was I took as many history classes as I could.
So, in those years, UW was essentially free. I mean, it was like $200. I think when
it was 160.
It was 250 when I started.
Yeah, I mean, it was just you know, and
there was that one period in the university's history where they had this idea that higher education should be essentially free in public institutions.
It was like at Berkeley.
It didn't last long, but it was there when we were lucky.
No, I mean, but I also lived at home because I was still working with my dad in you know, because my father was the last kosher butcher of Madison, Wisconsin. And so you know, after school, grade school, and then high school and even college until the store closed in 69, there I was, you know, working in the store afterwards, you know, cutting flanken. Cutting flanken right here, almost cut the entire, anyway, but so yeah, that's what I...
And that store was on Mill Street
and... Mills and Chandler.
I remember that place.
Yeah. Howard Temin, no, remember Howard Temin? He used to come there. Yes, and even after he won the Nobel Prize, he used to show up there, and I say, wow. You know, I didn't understand a thing he said, but it didn't make any difference. I still wrapped the meat as well as for anybody. So,
you came to campus in 1967. So what were your experiences? Did you get the feeling that the turmoil here in that year was appreciated in the rest of the city? What was the milieu like?
Because I lived on Chandler Street, and I went to Central. Most of the time, I didn't take the bus home. I'd walk home from Central, and I'd walk down State Street, and I walked down. Especially from like 10th grade on, I walked down State Street because I like looking at the girls and, you know, trying to get into bars I couldn't get into, even though it was like 18 at that time. And so what I would do is, and I've been wondering whether I can still do this, walk up Bascom. But I used to just, from the time I was about 15, I used to walk around the campus on the way home, you know, and then I'd go past, you know, maybe it's Van Vleck, you know, and then down, and then, you know, down Mill Street and stuff like that. I was there when the tumult began. You know, I would see, you know, demonstrations already by 65. And, you know, I'd read all the posters on the walls and the telephone poles. And I was just, wow, this is great. I mean, you know, in fact, it got to the point where I was skipping too much class in high school. I actually sat in on lectures. You know, I didn't know who these people were. I didn't even know what the lecture was, but I just sat in. I just wanted to see. I wanted to feel what the college experience was, and that's. And one time, I don't know. It might have been at Agriculture, Aggie Hall. There, that's where I stumbled onto Harvey Goldberg, and when I heard him, I was gobsmacked. I'd never seen anything like this in my life, you know. And I actually told the kids in high school about this guy, and they basically said, "Yeah, but what about the girls?" So I says, "Wait, forget about this. You you can't imagine this guy, you know." It's like, "Yeah, but what about the girls?" I was here when I was actually at the lecture where Wayne Morris and Ernest Gruening, the senators, the only two senators that voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, they were here. And ironically, Wayne Morris, and I went up to him, lived at my father's meat market in the 1920s. He had an apartment in there. It was at the corner of Mills And Mills and Chandler. Wayne Morris was there. You know, I was like, and
that's a name from the. Was he a UW grad?
Yes, yes, he was the senator from Oregon.
He's not remembered, but you're so right.
He should be remembered. I mean, you know, and same with the guy from Alaska, Ernest Gruner. And so, but I was there, and somewhere in the black hole I call my apartment, I still have their autographs. You know, and their little, and these, you know, the 3x5 note cards. But from the very beginning, I was, you know, I was really politically aware. And and what would happen is that, but so many of the boys that I hung around with couldn't wait to go into the Army. They couldn't wait to kill something because they were tired of just hunting deer. They wanted to kill something, you know. And back then, you know, you really, you know, their fathers were either, you know, had fought in Korea or World War II, and there was a different form of patriotism. You know, if the government said these guys are enemies, are villains, then they have to be killed. And of course, you know, there was that form of racism. I mean, that was the other thing. I mean, you know, they were yellow, so. They deserve what they got, that kind of, and they're commies. So
when did you decide then to focus on history? And
when I heard Harvey Goldberg.
Okay, so it was Harvey that.
And I was like 16, and again I just stumbled into that room, and I had. In fact, I even made a comment about that today on Facebook. To this day, I am just, you know, I am mesmerized by this man. And which is the reason why I surreptitiously taped him, even after he said, absolutely not, I don't allow taping. You know,
so how did you do that? You'd have to sneak the recorder.
Oh, this was great. This was like real, you know, black ops type of thing back then. I had my bar mitzvah bell and howl, this boxy thing, you know, that I had gotten in 1962, you know, with the little, you know, with the cord and the mic, and it wasn't like this at all. Okay. So I said to myself, how would I do this? And so I had watched enough James Bond movies and spy flicks in like Flynn and things like that every time I went in, and I wasn't this surreptitious with Mossy, because I never asked him. He didn't care. Harvey cared, you know. And you know, and I, like I said, the Taliban around him, his fanatics, would have beaten me to death figuring I was, you know, some sort of government agent. But what I did was that I taped. You've got to see this bell and howl thing. You know, I taped to my stomach. I weaved the mic cord all the way down here, and I always wore. And nobody seemed to pay any attention to the fact that even in the fall when it was really hot and humid, or the spring when it was, you know, you didn't need to wear all this bulky winter clothes, there's this guy, and he's sitting in the front row, and and I've got it right here, and I would always, when necessary, when I figured there was something, you know, there might be some sort of mic interference, I'd move the hand here, move it here, move it here. Nobody paid any attention. I think they were scared of me, because it was like, here's this guy, and he was, you know, he was wearing all this bulky stuff, and they were 60-minute tapes, and luckily, Harvey spoke literally for 60 minutes. He'd start, and, you know, and it was really weird because I wouldn't want to start the tape until he began. So I'd be doing all these sorts of gymnastic movements just so that I could, you know, push the plug in at the right moment, you know, and I did this dozens and dozens of times, and the tapes are in the you know, the Goldberg Center. And what I discovered when I was telling this to Professor McCoy, you know, when I finally gave him the tapes, this was, I think, 2004, maybe a little earlier, and I had kept these tapes in as pristine condition as possible in Dutch Master cigar boxes, literally under my bed and wrapped up in cellophane. You know, it's like, you know, it says, oh my God, the guy, you know, it's like the fanatics who handle comic books. Yeah. It's like, well, I did this. And there were dozens of them. And given the conditions, they're not bad. I've heard the digitized, copies, and they're, you know, there's a lot of ambient noise, of course. And I always try to stay away from anybody who talked in class, who laughed, clapped loudly. You know, there was one time where I was sitting in front of two girls who were talking about the dates the night before, and I basically turned around and said, shut the fuck up, you know? And I'm glad the boyfriends weren't there because they were like big, huge guys, I discovered. And they shut up, you know, because the master was speaking.
So what was it like in a Harvey class? I took his classes too, but...
when did you take them?
In the early 70s, 71, 72.
All right.
He was very much the same, but he was a performer.
Oh, yeah.
He engaged your attention.
He would walk... what he would do is he would walk out from one of the wings. You know, he'd just walk out. No notes. You know, and it's this kind of this hawk face, the nose, and you know, and very lean. I mean, just he was like emaciated, you know. And he also had like nasal problems sometimes, you know, sinus condition, and so
he smoked so much, 5 packs a day.
I mean, but we never saw that, you know. But he'd walk, and then he'd do a profile like Sarah Bernhardt. He would just, you know, and he'd do this, and then he'd start. Yeah, he would just do some sort of mannerism, take his glasses off, you know, he'd do this, and this, and then boom, he was off to the races. And in all the years and the dozens and scores of lectures I heard, he never stumbled once. He never said ah. It was as if he was on some sort of accelerated, you know, alternative plane, and he was speeding through the universe, and it was so erudite, and his references in French or in German, the dates were. They were always at the tip of his tongue. I've heard great speakers. I actually heard Martin Luther King here. You know, I've heard great speakers. I can imagine what William Jennings Bryan was, or the guys that would do the Chautauqua circuit. You know, I've never heard a speaker like that ever.
I could see where this would resonate in particular with what you said about storytelling as a child.
Oh, yeah.
And Harvey was a storyteller, and he told stories in an incredibly effective way, and in an accessible way for undergraduates.
You were swallowed into history. You were there at the barricades in, you know, in 1870s Paris. You were there, like, at the, you know, just imagine, you know, the visceral sensation of watching Eisenstein's, you know, Odessa step sequence. You were literally on those steps. You were in the syndicalist movement. You were there when Jean Jaurès was assassinated. I mean, it was like, you know, you were in the carriage when the, you know, Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot. You were sitting between him and his wife. I mean, you know, it was like that. It was one of those, and you know, you were at the guillotine. You were closer than Madame Defarge. I mean, you know, and he was just so much of a genius that you didn't really need to learn anything else. It was like, I've learned enough about the French Revolution because I have, you know, I've sat through a semester of Harvey Goldberg. And I'm not slighting Professor Mossy, sure. But his style was different.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to Mossy. So you took courses in tandem, Goldberg, yeah. Mossy, like yeah. many people did.
Yeah. A Petrovich class every so often. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that there was, in a sense, a competition yes. for students and the
oh, yeah, absolutely,
of them?
Absolutely. And but you know, the difference was, you know, and I said this to somebody, and it wasn't meant disparagingly back then, but I said, you know, Harvey is one of the Valkyries. Professor Mossy is Siegfried. Mm. He's he's Barbarossa. I mean, this guy is like, he's there. He's a pillar, you know? It's like, you're not going to get past him. But he was, but Professor Mossy's class was, in a way, totally different. Because it was far less emotional, but much more, there was much more of a sinister aspect because of, you know, and I always thought it was much more melancholy and dour, because when you're talking about Nazism, when you're talking about anti-Semitism, when you're talking about, you know, the European form of racism, the way Harvey described it, you couldn't wait to battle it. With Professor Mossy, it was like, you know, it was like the Johnstown flood coming towards you. There was nothing you could do about it. You just had to, you know, sit there and wait for the deluge. And
But the point was, in the end, the same. It was to make you think critically.
Oh, absolutely.
And act.
Oh, yeah. And, but the thing is, though, that George never said, jump on the barricades. Yeah. Harvey said, jump on the barricades, use your body, you know, that sort of thing, metaphorically. Mm-hmm. Metaphorically.
But he didn't.
No. Oh, he had a great place in Paris, that's what I hear, you know? And, but I was always surprised that the tapes that I had of Professor Goldberg were like the earliest extant ones. And I didn't understand that because, you know, he had been a professor at Ohio State in the early 60s, and he actually gave like radio lectures. But obviously they were never recorded. That I didn't understand. So, you know, I guess the late 70s, Harvey had no problem with having like professionals standing there with, you know, all the recording stuff. But so that's, I was really surprised by that. And even the lectures that I recorded of Professor Mossy's, there might be a couple of earlier ones, but not too many. And I didn't understand either.
Well, there the difference was that George was recorded for University of the Air and Harvey wasn't. I don't know why that's the case. Harvey never won a teaching award. He never was recognized by the university No. for his teaching. I don't know if his WHA would have not allowed him to be part of that series because of his political...
And he was not much of a... Other than his biography of Jaurès, he was not a writer. He was not
right.
a... You know, he wasn't a published
right.
professor.
That's right.
So
let's get to the 1971 class. This was the class, the first class that George taught specifically on Jewish history.
Yeah.
And you taped that class.
Yes.
It was it's a very historic class because it's one of the first courses in a public university.
See, I didn't know that. I figured they were doing this at NYU. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, but
for a public school, especially in the Midwest, I think it was really a pioneer course.
Yeah.
I think before that, George would integrate Jewish history in his other courses, but this was the first one that specifically was dedicated to Jewish history. So to some extent, he was writing the lectures as he went along, but they seemed to hold together coherently, and he focused on the German Jewish, and then he had others who actually went on to great careers, like Alice Alba, do the Eastern European history. But could you tell us a bit about how this class was received by the students? We noticed that in the questions and answers, the students seemed to have very little knowledge of Jewish history, and in particular of the Holocaust, and they were quite stunned. This again perhaps goes back to what you said about that you were, in George's case, pulled into the cruelty of history. You were pulled into the darkness of human behavior.
It must be a Jewish thing. I will tell you that the history that that George was talking about was not a history I was unfamiliar with. I mean, my dad came out of Eastern Europe. I mean, he lost his family, not in any of the concentration camps, but by partisans just shooting them in the head. I knew about Eastern European stuff. I also had read a number of books, you know, on the Enlightenment, on Moses Mendelssohn, on the rise of the Rothschilds. I mean, it wasn't unfamiliar territory, at least for me. For the others, yeah, I could tell that it was as unfamiliar as Catholicism might be to a Hindu, because it's like, and also remember back then, there was a tremendous amount of, you know, let's throw away any form of religiosity, unless it's like whatever the New Age thing was, you know. I remember talking to a lot of Jewish students from everywhere from New York to Skokie, you know, and they couldn't wait, you know, to disentangle themselves from, you know, the Yiddishkeit. You know, they, you know, and it's like, and I'm the son of the kosher butcher, you know, and, you know, it's like, I'm arguing with these people about, you know, you know, it's like, all of this stuff. And a lot of them had come from, like, you know, reform backgrounds. And, so it was, It was something that I had a great deal of difficulty with some of these students, because, as I said, no matter how far you run, they will always find you, you know, which is just so Jewish. It's like, you know, and but in that regard, it was true. And a lot of these, a lot of the Jewish kids might have heard about this from their, you know, their Bubby and their Zeta and, you know, that kind of stuff. And they ignored it. The non-Jewish kids, though, even by that time, had very little idea about the Holocaust, had no idea about Jewish history, other than the fact that, you know, as one of them said, I wanted to come in to see, you know, how they were running Wall Street, you know. So the you had that sort of, you know, that kind of anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. You know, which you hear today. I mean, you know, it's the dark forces that run the media and Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and it was a class that, if I remember correctly, was not packed. And it was, and the reading list was difficult, but it wasn't unfamiliar to me.
It was a capped class in that there was only a certain number of students that were allowed. It was a small class, probably because it was the first time they taught it. But we had the feeling of, just listening to some of the tapes, a kind of emotional intensity mm-hmm. that perhaps, as you said, this was the first time many of these students were engaged in this history. Yeah. And it did come at a particular time because, you know, in those years, the Holocaust still was not as prominent a part of Jewish identity.
I also think that Professor Mossy was digging really deeply into his own soul. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about, you know, intellectual history of, like, the 18th and 19th century. It's another thing to talk about the reason why you had to scram out of Berlin, you know, and that your relatives were involved, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, so there was, it was the sort of emotional impact that you could hear in his voice. Yeah. So, you know, it's, and so that was, you know.
I do think that George always used history to understand himself, that he used it, well, this is very simplistic, but almost kind of as a form of therapy. A form of understanding,
self-analysis,
personal, yes, through an intellectual engagement. I mean, I think, you know, when we thought about entitling his memoir "Finding Myself in History." We didn't use that title, but I think he did use history in that. And he used it throughout his career. He investigated areas of history that resonated with his own preoccupations. So perhaps this was the first time that he engaged in
that. I wouldn't know, but I, you know, it was. I found it a very edifying class,
thank you for taping it for us. Yeah, it's absolutely. Just really.
Oh, well, see, but I did that only because I wanted my dad to hear it, you know. And first time he heard Mossy's voice, he says, "Where's he from?" No, he's cool, Dad. He's cool. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, really? Okay.
His voice had about three different accents going at one time.
Yeah, you know, and well, I didn't realize. See, I didn't realize that no one else had, you know, was taping it. You know, it just, I did it because I wanted my dad to hear the tapes and my mom, but primarily my dad. And it was, yeah, he would always say, yeah, you know, I don't know much about, you know, the German Jews. When's he going to start on Polish ones?
So he says, he, you know what, I'll, you know, to it's like, I'll talk to him about it. Let's see what he does, you know? And so, yeah. But so anything to help.
Yeah. So the...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
The quality of the tapes are good, though, because I've heard the, you know, I never got a digital copy of the Mossy stuff, but I have all the Goldberg.
So we just went through a process of restoring the audio. We had done one pass of cleaning it up, but we, a specialist of continuing studies, went through and pulled out a lot of the ambient noise and the background noise, specifically for the course that we're offering, but that's something we'll do eventually with the whole series. But one of the questions we had was, do you know where the tapes, do you have those tapes still?
I gave everything to, what?
To,
well, Professor McCoy. Well, the original cassette. Well, we could ask Al.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I gave him my my Dutch master.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
You know?
Okay.
And, no.
Thank you.
Unless, of course, he has sold them on the black market. Yeah. That I can't tell you.
Yeah, yeah. And you said... Yeah, go ahead.
What do they have? They have to have them, otherwise.
So what I always had was an MP3. So they had been initially digitized.
Yes,
so
we had them digitized.
Right. But we thought with the process that we're going through, trying to clean them up, it might be easier if we read, because technology has come so far in the last 10 years since they were first.
Jeez, I hope he didn't throw them out.
I'll talk to them.
And we'll find them.
Yeah.
So
threaten him with tenure.
Yeah.
So many of the, much of the anti-war activity on campus in those years really originated in the history department and other departments in the humanities and social sciences.
Not in engineering.
Yeah, I mean, they were, of course, it was the draft, and so they could be pulled in as part of specific protests in a way that probably now would be much more difficult. But were you involved at all in the protests, and did you could you tell us about what it was like in the history department? In
Do you have David Moranis's Do you have a copy of it here?
Not in the office.
They marched into sunlight.
Do you actually?
I'll show you me.
You're in one of the.
I am in one of the definitive pictures of the Dow Chemical riots.
Huh.
I'll show you exactly where I am. You know, I was. You know, and oh yeah. I mean, I just.
So what motivated you to take part?
I was really pissed off. I mean, you know, I was even though, you know, the night of that draft where, you know, and I still remember it because I was there at the union, you know, and I talk about the wailing wall when some of the early numbers came up. Girls were crying, guys were crying, you know, and there was all this screaming and shouting going on at the student union. And I'm there with a couple of my friends, and I haven't heard my number. And I, you know, you just literally couldn't hear anything. So finally, I figured, oh, my God, I don't know what, I'm going to have to figure out a way. My dad had already said, you're going to Canada. And he was a professional soldier. He said, you're not going in. First of all, you'll shoot your own foot off. It's like, thanks, Dad. And, I wasn't gonna go to Vietnam, but but at the end of the evening, I discovered that my number was 362. It's like, wow, man! You know, all my other friends were like 303. You know, so we were lucky in that regard. And I will tell you, from that time on, I really saw a decrease in certain areas of radicalism, because if you were safe from the draft. You know, you didn't have the same sort of intensity. Obviously, not throughout the campus, and you had the you had the Army math bombing and things like that. But I did see a little more relaxation. But for those, it was interesting as there was a relaxation on one part, but there was more intensity and anger for those that were involved, you know.
They became more radical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Core.
I remember seeing Tom Hayden because, you know, he came out of Michigan. Mm-hmm. So, the 62 Port Huron statement for the SDS, yeah, he'd be there. He'd be walking around. But there was, what I did discover is the sort of phoniness that you see in political movements, especially here in America, where if it was too cold, hey, we're going to, you know, I remember going into the student union and, you know, and I noticed that during certain times of the afternoon when there were soaps that were going on, as God is my witness, you'd see these radicals watching the soaps and then they'd go out afterwards and, you know, they'd demonstrate.
That was what George always teased the students.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I think of any professor probably on campus, he probably was the one that was most...
He baited them.
Knowledgeable and prepared for the student rebellion or revolts of the 60s because he had been in Paris in the 30s and had witnessed a lot of mass demonstrations and been involved in that against the Spanish Civil War. And so he came with a lot of knowledge and background. And the students, I think he goaded the students and tried to get them to think more strategically.
Well, that, and, you know, it'd be one thing when Harvey would talk about, you know, the May 68 riots in Paris. And it was like, oh, my God, it's second only to Joan of Arc. You know, so it was that kind of intensity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, George would kick back and say, it's all bullshit. So they're not going to be able to do, you know, that sort of stuff. You know, it's like, I don't know whether he used the word bullshit. He might have in German. I don't know what it was. But, but you do have a sense of rationality among Professor Mossy's lectures. I mean, you know, it's, whereas, you know, Professor Goldberg was, okay, it's time to go to the barricades. Yeah. Again and again and again. No matter how many times, you're still going to go.
Yeah. I was thinking about a point that you made earlier about how Mossy's, or John, and you were talking about Mossy's biography, and in the 71 class, one of the questions students keep asking him is, why didn't Jews fight back? Like, why didn't they take arms? And I think maybe that did strike a personal note for Mossy, who left. And I was thinking about, and his response would always be, there was no coherent, there's no Jewish thing. That was something in Hitler's imagination. The Jews of Europe were spread across geography. They're spread across social boundaries. There's not a Jewish monolith.
Well, that along with the fact that, you know, nobody had the number of guns. My dad didn't see a gun until he joined the army. You had guns for hunting, but you didn't have the sort of lunatic proliferation you have in this country. And also, George tried to explain, that it's really, if you're a minority of 20 in a village, in the shtetl, how are you going to fight back, you know, with pitchforks? Especially when everybody, you know, for the last 200 years had been revved up to believe you were the devil itself. So, I mean, you know, you fought back, you know, when they finally got guns at the Warsaw Ghetto, they fought back and things like that. But it's, you can say the same thing about, you know, the slaughter of the Belgian Africans, you know, at the time of King Leopold.
Right.
Millions were killed. Okay. Yeah. Why didn't they fight? Why didn't the what was it, the Hutus fight back in Rwanda. There are times when you just can't.
Yeah.
You just, the thing, you fight by feet don't fail me now.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Well, George used to say that survival is a form of resistance.
Yeah.
Just being in such extreme circumstances.
I think that's partly why I spend so much time on the stereotype, to try and explain to the students that there's this thing in people's imaginations. They don't see Jews as a person. They have this idea that's been revved up, and he traces it. And I think it's in part in response to
you know what you see it today in alt-right terminology. It's not the ugly kind of anti-Semitism. It's like when that piece of shit Steve Miller, who's Jewish, from Santa Monica, whose parents are millionaires, use the word cosmopolitan, and right away what he's talking about. Mossy would have a field day with guys like that, because they really are the, what's the German term, the Jews that helped the Nazis, the Juden, right? The terminology has changed, but the emotions behind it remain the same, still red hot. And
well, perhaps we should move on now. Is there anything else you want to say about your time at UW? Other professors?
Well, I will say that if I hadn't had a girlfriend who typed all my papers, I'd probably still be a student, playing hearts in the union, right outside the Paul Bunyan Room, which hasn't opened yet. I will tell you that I don't think you really appreciate an education until years later. You don't appreciate teachers, the influence they have, unless you stay within academia. If you don't, it only comes back to you either when you decide you want to become reflective about life, or you have kids of your own. But I'm always talking up Wisconsin. I even though I live in Los Angeles, every day I read the Times, Channel 3000, Wisconsin Alliance, all this other stuff, and I'm always posting it on Facebook. People still think I live in Madison. So, no, I don't live in Madison. And I get really, really angry at the cuts Scott Walker and these mumsers are trying to do here. Yesterday, I was at the Special Collections Memorial Library, because there are a couple of things I've reached that certain age. There's nothing like having a 6-hour angioplasty, where they stick heart stents in and you hear doctors, hotshot cardiologists talking about a lot of stuff while you're watching, you're watching the transformation of a clogged up Mississippi River Valley, back into normal shape again, for you to start thinking about, geez, what am I going to do with all the crap that I've collected over the years? And so this is one of those times where, I was at the Chasen yesterday. There's stuff that, I want to give them. And there's some special collections books and things like that. It becomes, it's that sort of melancholy trip that you really don't want to take, but eventually,
There's also UW Archives if you have UW-related materials.
That's why I gave the tapes. I figured, what was the point of keeping those? Here we go with my mother again. I was talking to the special collections people yesterday, and I said, I had, because from like 1965 to 1971, I spent a good deal of my time taking posters off of telephone poles and walls, and once they were done, and collecting them and putting them away in nice little liquor boxes, you know, and from Sunoco, you know, and you know, the black light posters and all of this stuff, you know. And I tell my mother, don't throw them out. I'm only going to UCLA, you know. I am not going to the moon. I come back. This is 71. I come back, summer of 72, all gone. I said to her, Ma, what did you do? She says, well, you know, son, we didn't think you were ever going to come home again. And I said, Ma, I called you every other day. What are you talking about? He says, well, you know, you're not here. And so you don't love us. I mean, it's like, you know, something straight out of an Isaac Singer short story. And I says,
this brings up then your post UW career. What did you do? How did you end up in the entertainment business?
I slept with all the wrong people. What happened was, it's like I went out to UCLA Film School. I got accepted there, but I didn't like it. In fact, I basically dropped out after maybe a year and a half. Why? Because academically, it was the pits. You know, I had...
Do you want a water?
Oh, no, thank you. I had...
Especially compared to UW, right?
Yeah. I'm being serious about that. I had... My major professor in film was Russell Merritt.
Fantastic teacher.
PhD, you know, from Harvard in comp lit. And he used to say to me, he's Berkeley Emeritus now. He used to say to me, you don't study film as film. It's part of an interdisciplinary study. So in other words, if you're going to study film, you study it through English lit, French lit, history, comp lit, you know, economics. It doesn't make any difference. But it's not... The film is an art form, but it also is, as an art form, if you're studying Renaissance artists, you have to study Italian, you have to study the history, you have to know what's going on in Florence and Venice and Rome at the time. Okay. The teachers at UCLA at that time, and maybe still there, all they did was study film, but they studied film as if it were in a vacuum. They might as well have just been reading Daily Variety. I hated it. Hated it with a passion. There was no intellectualism. It was like a wasteland. And I was really pissed because I had also gotten accepted to NYU. And, you know, but I couldn't afford NYU. And I could afford UCLA only because if you stayed there for a year, you'd become a California resident. And... So I basically dropped out after about a year and a half. And I thought to myself, should I go back to Madison? No, because I don't want my mother telling me, well, I told you so. I honest to God. So I stayed out in Los Angeles, and I weaseled my way into a job. My girlfriend, who I met here in Madison, we went out together to Los Angeles. And... So she had gotten a job at J. Walter Thompson. And one day she says to me, Sydney, there's a job. I hear from a friend who's working at a TV station, Channel 9, which was General Tire at the time, which is now owned by Disney. the station, there's a job available there as a teletypist. You can type, and maybe you can go get the job and get off your ass. I says, okay. And I went there, I got the job. And the reason I got the job was that the person who had promised she wanted it had gone elsewhere, and they just needed somebody. And so I actually had to take a typing test. And so, and I had, prior to that, worked at the phone company for 18 months. As a teletypist. So I was really quick at this. So I got the job at Channel 9, and I got it through a woman named Shelby Conti, whose husband was a struggling composer named Bill Conti, who was the guy from Rocky eventually, you know, an Oscar winner, and, you know, but he's Bill Conti anyway. So that job led to a, because I like to talk to people, that job led to another job at Paramount Pictures Television, which was right across the street, which in research, again, as a typist, which led to a job at Hanna-Barbera in 1979. And I'm encapsulating all this because there are all kinds of weird stories that go along with this stuff. One of them, I got the job working at Hanna-Barbera through drugs, but not, I wasn't taking them, but the person who hired me was. And God is my witness, you know, and she got fired from Hanna-Barbera because she came out of the ladies' room with a milk sign, but got milk? Well, it wasn't milk. So they fired her and she says, you can't be taking coke. You work for Hanna-Barbera. You know, we do Scooby-Doo. What are you talking? You know, okay. Anyway, so, but I had been doing some freelance work for Hanna-Barbera while I was at Paramount. And I got fired because she had hired me. 6 weeks later, I say, man, I got to get this job, you know, because I'm losing too much money playing the horses at Santa Anita and Hollywood Park. That's what I used to do that. I used to make extra money, you know, trying to play the ponies as well as, you know, poker, because there were poker parlors back then. I was a real reprobate. I had just, you know, I would have probably ended up as something straight out of Guys and Dolls if I hadn't gotten this job. So I call up to get my Hanna-Barbera job back, which was just a freelance job. And the person who answered the phone was the person who had replaced the woman who had a coke problem, because she answered the phone because her secretary was in the bathroom. And one thing led to another, and this woman hired me, and this woman became my rabbi in a way. She hired me and fired me three separate times, all for insubordination over the years, different jobs. And so she hired me at Hanna-Barbera. She hired me 10 years later at Marvel Entertainment. And then a year after that at Fox Kids, where I became, everybody got to know me because of the shows I worked on, like in animation, like X-Men and Batman and Beetlejuice and Spider-Man and Silver Surfer and Goosebumps. And so, I mean, you know, that's basically, you know, that's...
So you kind of fell into it, it sounds like.
I fell into it because, and a lot of people fall into it.
Right.
Because those of us who didn't, you know, when I went to UCLA, I didn't want to become, you know, a production person. I wanted to be Harvey Goldberg or George Mossy. And I knew I couldn't because I don't speak like that, you know? So, and I just ramble on, and I just, you know, it's my stories, most of them are, you know, except the ones I tell you, you know, there's a lot of tall tale-isms about it, you know, that sort of stuff. I fell into it like a lot of people. And I've spent 40 years in kids programming.
What are you most proud of in terms of your in kids programming?
The X-Men. The X-Men show, because they still talk about it today, because this is an animation from, it basically revived the Marvel Universe. It proved you could do this. Singer, the director of the first X-Men movie, never read a comic book. He said, I only watched the series to get my, to understand that world. And I was the network executive on that show, which meant that everything passed by my desk. all concepts, all scripts, all storyboards, all the post production. You know, I was there with the editors and all this other stuff, and to this day, it's probably the most sophisticated storytelling for a child. I don't know if you have ever watched it.
Yeah, I have.
You know, and so, and this, the animation might have sucked, but those stories, man,
yeah.
they were multi-leveled. There was, there was a character Beast, who would always quote Voltaire and Shakespeare. I mean, I got away with murder on this because it was my show and nobody could touch it. And I did stuff that had never been done before in, you know, for kids programming. And I made those kinds of references. And that sort of stuff has been lost today because the people who make these decisions are stupid and they don't believe that kids are smart enough. And even though, you know, you've got 6-month-olds with their computers in front of them, and you know, but so yeah, that I'm also proud of surviving, you know, because it was not an easy business, and because you're always fighting for tenure, and that's that, you know, you're only as good as you're not good at all. No matter, forget about what you just did. What are you going to do for me now? Type of thing.
Well, is there anything else you want to say about your education or your career or UW
you know about the award I set up?
Yeah.
I can thank the history department for that, because when I set up my award, and I had no idea how to do this, but, you know, this was like in the early 90s. And I thought, you know, I got to give back. I don't know how to give back, but it's a mitzvah. You got to give back. Okay. I, through the UW Foundation, I created this award for undergraduates. graduating seniors, honors thesis. The ones who wrote the best honors thesis, but it also had to be interdisciplinary. So, you know, if you were a history major, you had to have, you know, you had to have a minor in art or Italian or, you know, geography. It didn't make any difference. And that's, I was able to fund this through, and it was hard, but then I never got married, never had a house, and so I didn't have kids. So basically, you know, what I wasn't, you know, spending on, you know, on children's book illustrations, which I started collecting only to hide the earthquake cracks in my various apartments in Los Angeles. No, I'm being serious about that. You know, these spider cracks that eventually turned into like, abysses. I was just, they were awful. I would put artwork there, but anyway, so, I'm really proud of that, because that award, you know, in fact, that was the reason why I was at the Humanities Place, which is, you know, University Club building. I always look forward, you know, to like May when I get to read these theses. And I will tell you, I set this thing up so that in a dozen lifetimes, it would have been impossible for me to win this thing. I mean, some of these kids are so incredibly smart that I can't even understand the titles. And I'm not joking about this. I mean, in fact, I was going to have lunch, but she's busy on campus, with one of the winners a couple of years ago. Her father is like a professor of mechanical engineering here. And she wrote something on theology and the video game World of War. I've never played World of War, and all the levels and all this other stuff. And she was the winner. She created she saw God in all of this stuff and the numbers, and because she was also into mathematics, and you know, so, and she was a game. She was like a game player. So she wins this thing, and I, you know, I. I never met any of the winners except this one person when I came back in May of 2014 for a memorial service for one of my close friends. And I was at Tandem Press, and she was there that night. And I introduced myself. She said, well, I remember, yeah, you won my award. Yeah, okay. Can you explain to me what that thesis of yours was? And she tried to, and I said, oh, forget it. Forget it, man. I don't, you know, you won, you know, Zygesund, you know, and that kind of stuff. And I said, so where are you going? So he says, oh, I'm going to MIT. He says, really? Yeah, I'm going to MIT. I got accepted to game theory. I says, great, you know, that's great. I can't even spell theory, and you know, and but that's what I'm really, that's the proudest thing I, you know, great. So.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate taking the time to come and visit with us, and thank you again for taping the lectures.
How many of these do you guys have?
Seven.
Seven what? How many Mossy oral histories?
Oh, the oral histories? We've got quite a few, yeah.
I'm not sure of the Mossy program specific ones. Or...
Yeah, I'd have to count them up. Yeah. There's probably around 10.
You know, now you've...
But you're the first undergrad we've done.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
Well, great.
Yeah, you were the first of what we hope are many.
Now, you can... Now, let's... if you've got a few minutes, yeah, let's get back to the Greenbush thing.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
I am telling you, the shenanigans that went on to get rid of hundreds of people, you know, that had created a community there since the turn of the last century.
Right.
You know, they ripped them out of their homes. Mm-hmm. They paid at best, you know, 20 cents to the dollar. They promised a lot of these old people that they would be coming back, which of course they never did. They ripped out the name. You know, I think of it as like Cabrini Greens. You know, they rip out, although, it was like urban blight. We're going to make Madison beautiful again type of thing. And I always thought it had something to do with the John Nolan Causeway because, you know, you're coming in from areas you don't want to see. You don't want to see Fort Apache here. And it wasn't Fort Apache, but I mean, it was a blighted area. And so, you know,
there was all this money that all of a sudden became available in Washington. And of course, this was a national phenomenon. And it was Nestegan, progressives that plugged into that money. And this area of Madison was the only area that, in the sense, housed any kind of difference, in the sense that pretty much everyone else in the town was German or white Northern European. Yeah. It was the one area that they could identify, and it also was next to the university and next to the hospital. So it had, there were vested interests that wanted that area closed so they could grow. So there were, I think, a lot of economic reasons for it. I mean, the neighborhood, if it had evolved, I mean, I think people were beginning to move out of the neighborhood, well, the younger generation
was,
it would have been restored is probably what would have happened over the years. It would have been, you know, gentrified, I guess.
It would have been like Willie Street, you know.
Yeah,
but
that's what it had,
but the thing is that they used a sledgehammer and they used a lot of lies. Yeah. And I remember Longfellow School used to have these meetings, and it got really, really heated because there were, you know, there were urban groups at that time who knew exactly what was happening, and you had a lot of white radicals who were part of that as well. And but it's fascinating if you go back and read the Cap Times and the State Journal about all the, you know, the promises that turned into anguish. And it just drove, you know, we were driven out. My parents were driven out of that place. And if you notice that they tore down the triangle area, but they didn't move past Mills. You know, they got, you know, where Madison General Meritor is now. They only got rid of like one building, which was, I believe, St. Joseph's Church. because I was there, I was watching, and when that went down in like 62, 63. It was really interesting that suddenly that area, which was also considered Greenbush, wasn't touched. It was just the area, you know, with the Pele and the Gurkhi junkyards.
But
and
they got rid of the Schwartz Pharmacy that went right up to Madison General. Those two brothers, and then they moved into the first floor of a new development.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
But I do recall they tore down that.
It's a fascinating history because they tear it down, they build up a Soviet style, which they're trying to tear down now, apartment building, and for years, decades actually, there were vacant lots. Mm-hmm. There were just vacant lots. It's like, wait a minute, you were promising all these old, and you know, it's basically all the old people died. They all just died. And so you've got a couple of, you can see I'm still pissed off about this because I remember going to these meetings and these old folks, you know, they were in their 60s, 70s, 80s. They were crying because they were being thrown out of their homes and they really didn't know where, you know, where they were going to end up. So they ended up on the South Side, you know, and you've never had as integrated an area of Madison since then.
Oh, it's true.
You really haven't. And, you know...
That's true all over the country. That's what happened. You took integrated neighborhoods and separated them out, basically.
And it was a working class neighborhood. It wasn't, you know, where everybody was on welfare. I mean, you know, they worked at Gisholdt, Rayovac, Oscar Mayer. And so, again, you know... There's you can compare it. You're right. The federal response after World War II, of you know, getting rid of certain areas and building them up and trying to create suburban plots. Well, you know, I'm just telling.
Right.
So, but
so what are you doing the rest of your time here in Madison?
I am. I'm having lunch with a guy named David Muscat. I don't know if you know who he is.
No, I've never heard
David
of
Muscat runs the Facebook. You guys got to get on Facebook. runs Historic Madison.
Oh, okay.
And so he basically takes the archival photos and puts them up, and you know of Madison, of the surrounding areas, you know. And it's fascinating because most of these buildings no longer exist.
And you have photos of the bush. I noticed that on your Facebook page.
Yeah,
right? You put up some very
and you know
interesting old photos.
And he's got you know, and then people respond. It's like, oh, I remember that. Yeah, I was there. And then there's you know there's Stu Levitan's. If you grew up in Madison and Madison in the '60s and Lost Madison.
You know, the Ben Sidran, Ben and Judy are organizing the 60s Fest next summer. You know about that?
Yeah.
Are you in touch with them? Or?
I'm not in touch. I'm in touch with Stu Levitan, but I'm not in touch with Ben Sidran. I'm wondering whether I'll come
you
back.
Should,
to,
you should.
Yeah.
You
it's
know.
It's going to be Errol Morris supposedly coming.
Yeah.
And,
You
remember that Marge Tabankin? Do you remember her? She was very active politically, but there's a lot of people that are going to come back for that.
Yeah,
Ben
and cool. We'll all be, you know, showing up with walkers, you know, comfort dogs and things like that. But I don't know. Maybe
run on the Depends. Over there.
You know, it's like you know what we'll do is we'll do a reenactment of the Dow Chemical riots around B10 Commerce. If you have that book around, I will show you my.
We will. Yeah. I know I have a copy of it. I'll look it up.
You know,
and, yes.
I am in that picture where the cops have charged out of the building, and one guy is about to get hit in the head with a baton. I am two people behind that, and you know, kind of bug eyed. It's like you know.
What's happening?
What's happening? That was the.
I see we have a copy of Rads there right behind you, but that
This was a Daily Cardinal picture that went all across the country.
Did you know that we had a reunion of the people who were in Vietnam on that specific day?
No, I didn't.
The radicals. That was organized by Dave Marinus and the Mossy Program and WHA. And that was really fascinating because we brought back soldiers and then the protesters. And it was really, it was an amazing event. That was one of I think, the most interesting things we've done.
And you realize that the reason why nobody's protesting today, it's a professional army and there's no threat of a draft. That's why there's such lassitude, you know.
You know, I heard something this weekend that surprised me, and that is that there are, in particular, women who are on campus here. They dress very glamorously. They're very stylish, and on the weekends they go to New York and they work as escorts.
Get out of Dodge.
Can you imagine? But sometimes what they do is they are paid to attend events. Everything is faked these days. Like they'll go to a bar. They'll be paid to go to a bar. Yeah. Or they'll...
Is that the image?
That's it. I'll show you exactly where I am.
Yeah, oh, cool.
I just thought that was like, that's so telling about where we're at, yeah. You know, as a country. You know, but why not? You know, you're spending all that money being glamorous. You might as well make some money back, right?
There you go. That's crazy.
I am... right there.
Oh, right behind you. Okay.
Right there.
Nice. Oh, wow.
And I think I still have those glasses right there.
Okay. Oh, for look at that.
Mm-hmm.
You're part of history.
Yeah, no, part of history.
Yeah.
The I also knew that the revolution was lost because